I suppose there's no chapter in the Bible that's occasioned more controversy over the years than the very first chapter of all, Genesis chapter 1. For the skeptic, it's to this chapter he turns for what he takes to be undeniable evidence that the Bible makes mistakes. For many Christians, it's to this chapter they turn to provide them with the touchstone of biblical inerrancy. And the reason, of course, is quite simple. Genesis, as its name implies, is a book about beginnings. It introduces countless themes that, like threads in a piece of material, are woven together in the later books of the Bible to make the whole tapestry of biblical revelation. It sets the scene for the mighty drama of God's plan of redemption. To try to understand the Bible without first reading Genesis is like coming into a theatre halfway through and trying to make sense of the play. The plot is bound to confuse us. Every story must have a beginning. Genesis 1 is the beginning of God's story. History is his story. But of course, over the last 100 years or so, a new version of history's origins have become popular, a version based not on divine revelation, but on scientific investigation, a version which it's claimed appeals not to faith, but to reason. And this new book of Genesis, which modern man has written, seems in many fundamental ways to contradict the account of the Bible's book of beginnings. And that's why the controversy rages. So it seems, before we settle down to examine these early chapters of Genesis, which we're going to do over the next 10 weeks or so, it would seem sensible to make a few observations about this collision between science and the Bible, which troubles and challenges so many, particularly of our younger people. If you look on the white bulletin, you'll see that three issues, it seems to me, complicate this whole debate about creation and Genesis chapter 1. These three issues are the inconclusiveness of the scientific evidence, the difficulties of biblical interpretation, and what I've called the subtleties of humanistic philosophy. I want us to look at those three things this morning. First of all, the inconclusiveness of the scientific evidence. You know, I think the impression is often given, particularly to children at school, that science now has an understanding of the origin of the universe which is settled beyond all reasonable dispute. Now, that simply isn't so. Take, for instance, the notorious theory of biological evolution, which precipitated the controversy when it was first formulated by Charles Darwin in the middle of the last century. Now, in 1960, Dr. G.A. Kirkut, a professor of comparative biochemistry and physiology at Southampton University, wrote a textbook, which was published by Pergamon Press, entitled The Implications of Evolution. As far as I know, Dr. Kirkwood isn't a Christian. He's certainly not an apologist for the scientific accuracy of Genesis 1. But in his book, he makes an outspoken attack on the shaky empirical foundations for much of evolutionary theory, which is taught as fact in schools and colleges today. He lists in chapter 2 of his book 7 assumptions which evolutionary theory makes and shows how each one of them is at the present time incapable of experimental verification. Now, don't misunderstand me. Dr. Kirkwood himself accepts the evolutionary model as basically right. The reason he says he wrote his book is that he's very concerned that his students should be fully aware of the provisional nature of that theory, of that model. He says it's going to need considerable modification, perhaps even complete alteration, before it comes anywhere near to fitting the facts in such a way that it can claim to be more than a theory. He says in his book, it may be distressing for some readers to discover that so much zoology is open to doubt. But this, in effect, indicates the vast amount of work that remains to be done. Much of what we learn as facts today are only half-truths or less. Now, it's very essential, I think, that we understand this, that the theory of evolution is itself evolving. The scientific evidence is by no means conclusive for the theory as it's presently taught. When we examine the theory of evolution as it's applied to geology and the origin of the Earth, we find a similar catalogue of unproven assumptions. Much of the modern science of geology rests on the work of Charles Lyell, who did for geology very much what Darwin did for zoology in the last century. according to Lyell's theories, small gradual changes in the geology of the world have been magnified into large effects as a result of their continuing over millions and millions of years. He believed it was possible to extrapolate back from the present into the indefinite past without encountering any sudden discontinuities. And for that reason, his sort of geology is sometimes called uniformitarian. But you know, that really is a very big assumption. For why should there not have been huge catastrophes punctuating the history of our Earth? The world is not without evidence of such momentous upheavals. Enormous quantities of information in support of such dramatic events have been summoned together by the author Immanuel Velikovsky. His books, like Worlds in Collision, stand very much on the fringe between science and science fiction, I think. But there can be no doubt that he has shown there are a great many facts that are cavalierly ignored by uniformitarian geology simply because it doesn't fit in with their scheme of things. And if such cosmic catastrophes have taken place in the lifetime of our Earth, there can be no doubt that the whole scientific account of geological origins would have to be thrown into the melting pot. Because all the present methods of dating rocks and fossils, for instance, hinge on the fact that there have been no gross discontinuities in world history. So it's important we understand that science, like all constructs of human reason, is an interpretation of a limited number of facts based on certain fundamental assumptions. It may get its facts wrong, it may make wrong assumptions, and if it does, then its theories will be wrong. Science has progressed by identifying erroneous theories, and it identifies erroneous theories by facing up to facts which don't fit its old ideas. Scientific ideas of world origins are still at a very early stage. And we ought not in 1980, therefore, to treat the sort of ideas that scientists currently express as some kind of final verdict by science on the matter. The scientific evidence up to date is simply inconclusive. And I think most honest scientists would have to admit that there's still a huge question mark over that mysterious beginning of which Genesis 1 speaks. Now, of course, some Christians would eagerly seize upon any admission like that. Ah, they say, so it all happened in 7 days, like Genesis says. It's evolution that's the big myth, not Genesis 1. But, you know, to be fair, the biblical case is not as unambiguous as some people make out either, because there are genuine problems of interpretation regarding Genesis chapter 1 that were recognized by thoughtful expositors long before the current debate took off about creation. One of the most important questions we have to ask when we come to this chapter is, what literary form does it take? Should we read it as history, like the books of Samuel, for instance? Most unusual history, if so, because unlike the books of Samuel, there was no human eyewitness, no human historian involved in recording it. Or should we read it as poetry, like David's Psalms? There is a certain parallelism in the structure of it, after all. The first 3 days paralleling the second 3 days. Light, sea, and land being a triad you find in each of them. Or should we treat it as an apocalyptic vision? A vision of the beginning corresponding to John's great vision of the ending on the Isle of Patmos. After all, Genesis chapter 2 mentions a tree of life, and that reoccurs in Revelation chapter 22. Is Genesis 1 and 2 then a symbolism, just as the book of Revelation is? Or should we read it as a prophetic message, a word from God about the past, just as Jeremiah and Isaiah and such like were favored sometimes with words from God about the future? It's all very well, you see, to say we must take the Bible literally. But we do not take David literally when he says, God prepares a table before me in the presence of my enemies. We don't take Daniel literally when he sees a beast with 10 horns arise out of the sea. Many Christians would feel it was wrong to take Isaiah literally when he speaks of a child playing on the cobra's nest and the lion eating straw like an ox. The Bible has to be interpreted. I may say something true, and yet I may be misunderstood by my hearers, and so he construes my truth as if it were a lie. In the same way, the Bible can be the infallible word of God, having no intention to deceive, speaking the truth to us, and yet be the victim of fallible interpreters who pontificate too glibly, the Bible says. I may have a personal conviction about how Genesis 1 should be interpreted. But unless I want to play Pope and personally adjudicate the meaning of Scripture for the whole of Christendom, then I must be open to the possibility that I am mistaken in my understanding sometimes. Every Bible student knows there are some texts which he interprets differently now from what he did 10 years ago. Why should Genesis 1 be immune from that kind of honest reappraisal? We certainly ought not to anathematize Christians who interpret this chapter differently from us. There are open questions about it. So you see, we don't have here a straightforward contradiction in this controversy between the Bible and science. What we have, rather, are two overlapping clouds of uncertainty, a scientific cloud of uncertainty and an uncertainty of biblical interpretation. And the problem is very much, how do we resolve such a tenuous debate? Some people say, oh, hang science, I believe the Bible. They insist that it's wrong to allow science even to mildly influence our interpretation of the Bible. They say we should interpret the Bible as if science didn't exist. But you know, that seems to me to be very obscurantist. Because science is a perfectly valid extension of our human experience. If the Bible had said the moon was made of green cheese, then I could no longer take that verse literally, for we verified scientifically the moon is made of rock. Mercifully, the Bible doesn't say the moon is made of green cheese, but it does say the world was made in 7 days. The question is, does it intend us to take that literally or not? And the internal evidence of the Bible itself isn't conclusive, to my mind, on the point. A reasonable case could be made out for interpreting Genesis 1 in a number of ways. So there seems to be nothing wrong in allowing science to help us to distinguish which of these possible interpretations is the more likely. After all, archaeology has cast enormous light on extremely perplexing Old Testament texts. There are some verses in the Old Testament that were practically untranslatable and certainly unintelligible until we made certain discoveries in archaeology that settled the linguistic or the cultural setting of the verse. And there's no difference in principle from extra knowledge, that is extra biblical knowledge, shedding light on a passage in, say, Deuteronomy, and it's shedding light on Genesis 1. The Bible isn't afraid of facts. We give the impression that the Bible must be shielded from facts, then how can we claim it's true? No, we must aim to harmonize our science and our interpretation of the Bible. We can't allow these two aspects of our knowledge to be divorced into antagonistic compartments of our minds. The problem is how. Now, of course, there have been a variety of attempts to bring science and Genesis 1 together. You can classify them into two basic groups. One group of writers, generally speaking, accept the evolutionary theory of origins, which they judge to rest on sufficient scientific evidence to place it beyond reasonable doubt, even though the details may still be questioned and in debate. Some of these writers treat Genesis 1 in a totally non-literal way. They say it is a poem designed to teach theology, not science. Some of these writers adopt a position called theistic evolution. That is, they believe that evolution was the mechanism that God used to create the world. They say with some justification that evolutionary theory as it stands contradicts a fundamental thermodynamic law of the universe. There is no way without some driving energy that complex things ought to evolve spontaneously from simple things, according to the laws of physics. And they would say that it is God who's provided that creative energy which drives evolution. They would argue that these 7 days of Genesis 1 perhaps represent 7 great ages in which evolution took place. It is interesting, after all, that Genesis 1 does represent creation as taking place progressively over a period, and that, generally speaking, the stages of first of all matter and then vegetation and then animal life, do, generally speaking, correspond to the direction in which evolution is regarded as taking place. They point out with some justification that the evening and the morning were the first day must mean something other than a literal day in a world that doesn't yet have a sun. One interesting speculation that some of this school have made is that the prophet Moses was actually shown a vision of the origin of the world from the initial big bang of light energy through to the eventual emergence of man at the very end of it in a kind of time-collapsed vision which took place over a week, so that the 7 days are not days of creation but days of the prophet's revelatory experience. Another popular theory you may have come across, though to my mind rather more far-fetched, argues that there should be a gap between Genesis 1, verse 1, and verse 2. You will see, if you have an NIV, that it is possible, though not natural, to translate verse 2, "Now the earth became formless and empty." In other words, these writers argue there's a huge lacuna before the 7 days of creation of which Genesis speaks. And we know nothing about what happened in that great gap. But into that great gap, conveniently, we can throw geological and biological evolution. So that Genesis only deals with relatively recent history of the world. Well, there are many Bible-believing Christians who are prepared to accept the evolutionary theory and to harmonize it with Genesis 1 in one or other of these ways. And it seems to me their position, given the limitations of scientific evidence and the difficulties of biblical interpretation, is a permissible one. On the other hand, there are a group of men, Christian men, who reject the evolutionary model, at least as a complete explanation. They feel that science hasn't taken serious enough the possibility of catastrophes in world history. They point out very validly that if 7-day creation had taken place, exactly as Genesis 1 says, it would be a very extreme form of anomaly in world history, and science would find it very hard to investigate it. For instance, if God makes a mountain in one day and presents it to a geologist, he would quite undoubtedly say that it had been there for 1 million years. Creation builds in age. How old was Adam the day he was created? Most pictures make him look about 30. Did he have a navel? And did the tree of life have rings if they'd cut it down? Another more complex and sophisticated sort of argument that some are using these days is to point out that science has begun to realize in the last few decades that time is not a continuous and an unvarying quantity. Since Einstein's famous work on relativity, we now realize that the speed at which time passes depends on the distribution of matter in the universe and its velocity. In the cosmic upheaval of a creational situation, who can say what might or might not happen in 7 days? Well, the major difficulty with these kinds of theories, of course, is the fossil record. If God did make the world only 10,000 years ago or so, it seems he has intentionally made it look much older by creating apparent evidence of earlier life which never actually existed. The theorists of the 7-day creation school generally believe that these things can all be explained by a second catastrophe, the catastrophe of Noah's flood. That during this second unparalleled upheaval, geological strata were dislocated and great changes took place in world topography within a very short space of time. Though a uniformitarian theory would suggest that they took millions of years. Well, there's increasing support for this very cavalier, bold approach to the problem of harmonizing Genesis 1 with scientific observations, and quite a number of distinguished scientists are lending support to this kind of theory. But it's a long way short yet of capturing the consensus of the scientific community generally. Maybe it will. Maybe further work will convince us that at least this alternative catastrophic model is as good as the evolutionary model. Or maybe, in spite of all the present enthusiasm for books like The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris that I expect you've seen, science will eventually refute its ideas. Who can say? At present, all we can say is it's an open question. Genesis 1 and the scientific account of world origins must ultimately be complementary, not contradictory. But how precisely that harmony is to be established, neither the scientist nor the Bible student are in any position to be dogmatic about at the moment. Maybe they never will. I suppose some of us, who are not particularly scientifically oriented, would be inclined to say in response to that, well then, does it matter what we think about Genesis 1? Can't we just ignore this great controversy that's exercised so many brains and caused the writing of so many books? Can't we just say that any verdict is premature at the moment and forget about it? Well, no, I don't think we ought to do that. I think every one of us has got to make it our business to do as far as we can understand these issues in this long-standing debate, not because we can necessarily give a final answer to it, but for this reason. There are certain anti-Christian forces in our world who have tried to exploit this whole debate about evolution and creation to their own atheistic ends. And that's what I'm getting at when I talk about the subtleties of humanistic philosophy. You see, if this debate was simply one about scientific theory and biblical exegesis, then we could safely leave it to the scholars. All of us normal people could just shove it all over to the university faculty and tell them to sort it out for us. And that would be a perfectly legitimate thing to do. But unfortunately, the contest has been extended far beyond that, into the realm of politics and ethics and of religion generally. It's possible, you know, to observe the influence, not of evolutionary theory, but of evolutionist philosophy on practically every development of Western culture in the last 100 years. If you read some of the early capitalists, you find them defending the way in which the weak perished under capitalist competition on the grounds that it was survival of the fittest. If you read the early socialists, you find they defended their utopian dream of a perfect society on the grounds that man was constantly evolving to become better and better all the time. If you read the early Marxists, you find they justify and still do their revolution on the grounds that they're just helping historical evolution along a bit. And if you read some of Hitler's writings, you will find that he justified his extermination of the Jews on the grounds that they were missing links in the chain of man's subhuman ancestry. And he justified his experimentation with genetic engineering on the grounds that by this means the superiority of the Nordic races could be further upgraded by suitable guided evolution. It's evolutionist philosophy more than anything else that has blinded man in the 20th century to the brutality and irresponsibility of his century, that has filled his mind with false hopes and blunted his moral conscience. And still the media churn it at us, ridiculously optimistic farces entitled The Ascent of Man. Now let's be quite clear about this. This kind of evolutionist philosophy is quite different from the evolutionary theory of which scientists speak. Scientific theories are simply models by which diverse observations are integrated. They describe as best they can the way things are. They make no attempt to give ultimate explanations. Evolution may be how the world happened, or it may not. But it has no relevance at all to the question of why the world happened. But what humanism has done is to exploit this air of intellectual respectability that surrounds the idea of evolution, but to subtly transform it from being a theory of science into being an article of faith. Humanism has given evolution a capital E and made an idol of it. Evolution has become the god of human progress, a mysterious power guiding human history, which men actually believe in. Just trust the evolutionary process, says Timothy Leary. It's all going to work out all right. I tell you, in the whole history of human civilization, Satan has never more effectively deceived the human race than he has with that evolutionist philosophy. Baal and Ashtaroth never threatened the moral life of Canaan as do this god of 20th century materialism. The idols of Greece and Rome never filled the minds of those nations with such false optimism as does the idol of this contemporary humanism. And I say it's against these pernicious influences that we need to assert the authority of Genesis 1. Not so much as against evolution as a mechanism for the origin of the world, but against evolution as an explanation of the origin of the world. That's what we must reject. With that in mind, I want us to look at these early chapters of Genesis. We shall perhaps comment now and again as we're going through them on questions of history as to how the scientific and historical account fits in with what we read in these chapters. But that is not going to be our major interest. Our major interest is going to be to unravel the moral and religious and spiritual implications of these chapters and to see how they stand against the humanistic spirit of our age. Now, we're going to begin that this morning only with the first heading, which you see under the implications of creation, because the others will take us into next week. The nature of God, the God who speaks. Let's just look at the God who is presented to us in Genesis chapter 1 and see how he contradicts evolutionist philosophy and the atheism of our contemporary era. In the beginning, we read, God created the heavens and the earth. Here then is a self-existent God presented to us. Who made God? That's the question children ask. And the answer, of course, is no one. He is eternal, the first cause. With this creative act, the flux of change we call time starts to flow. There is a beginning. Men have tried to demonstrate the existence of God on occasions, but the Bible makes no such futile attempts. God can't be proven by logic for the simple reason his existence doesn't follow from anything. He is the ultimate point of origin, from which all other things derive. But he is himself underived. So we can't deduce that he exists. There's nothing to deduce him from. If you presented a computer with all the facts of the universe, it wouldn't churn out logically QED, therefore God exists. Now, man perceives the existence of this God intuitively. It's a self-evident truth, for which there is no proof, and for which no proof is necessary. The man who says there is no God is not condemned in the Bible for being unintelligent, but for being a fool. A fool who cannot see what is staring him in the face. A self-existent God, then. A spiritual God, too. The earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. According to Eastern thought, the universe is in some sense made out of God. The material world is a manifestation of the divine. And we call a belief like that pantheism. But this verse declares that the Bible has no such speculation about the relationship of the universe to God. God is spirit, and as spirit he is separate from the world. And though he is intensely concerned for it, he's pictured here hovering over it like a mother bird over its young. But he's not identified with it. He creates the world. He doesn't turn into it. A spiritual God. But most important of all in this chapter, what we're confronted with is a personal God. And God said, let there be light. A God who speaks. Like a poet, he creates the world by the power of his words, but with an important difference. There's nothing imaginary about his word. This artist is able to call things into existence out of nothing. He can give reality to his creative ideas. When he says, let there be light, it's not a flash of aesthetic fancy. It's not a wish. It's a command. And there was light. See, inherent in this majestic description of creation that follows, we find the emphatic rejection of every kind of false god the world has known. Many of the old religions believed that the universe was made out of a contest between good and evil forces. Dualism, we call it. But this God acts alone. He experiences no opposition to his divine will. He speaks, and it is so, and it is good. Many of the old religions worship the sun. But here is a God who made the sun and defined its function as a light bearer. Many pagan religions follow astrology, but here is a God who made the stars and appointed them as signs for seasons, not as masters of human fate. Many pagan religions center around fertility cults, but here is a God who commanded that mysterious productive energy. Be fruitful and multiply, he says, defining the species of plant and animal and appointing their mode of reproduction. Every kind of superstition and idolatry is undermined here. The creator is not to be confused with the creation. He is distinct, as a speaker is distinct from his speech. See how he stands aloof from this world like an artist and passes a value judgment on it. It's good, he says. And notice how he asserts his mastery over what he's made by defining its name. He calls the light day, and the darkness he calls night. Creation here, then, is no random event. This beginning of which Genesis speaks is a purposeful decision by a God who knew what he was doing, a personal God, a self-existent, spiritual, personal creator, whose act of creation was at the same time an act of self-expression, a manifestation of self-conscious identity. God said, "Let there be light." And there was. Now I say all that so clearly contradicts our modern evolutionist philosopher. Our 20th century evolutionist philosopher tells us that matter is eternal. He tells us that the ultimate truth behind our universe are the scientific laws that govern the interaction of radiation and atoms. Evolutionism tells us that our world emerged by a chance collision of particles, a random event in a meaningless universe. That isn't science. That is speculation. And Genesis 1 says no to it all. It says, in the beginning, God. You may harmonize this chapter with scientific theories of evolution, but there is no way it can be harmonized with atheistic philosophy. The ultimate truth behind the universe is not impersonal energy, but a living spirit. And the ultimate director behind this universe is not mathematical equations, but a personal will. That's what Genesis 1 asserts. Modern man runs away from such a God. He prefers his evolution with a capital E. He prefers a world that happened by accident and makes progress by chance. He does not like a world that begins with the sovereign voice of a personal God speaking out of the darkness. And the reason he prefers those things is simple. A God who can command the light to shine is a God who can command him. A God who can distinguish good from evil in the world he has made is a God who can evaluate us. And we do not want to be commanded. We do not want to be evaluated. It's this moral rebellion that lies behind so much of the irrational commitment to evolutionism that one finds amongst thinking people today. Listen to this from Aldous Huxley. He comes from one of the greatest evolutionist families of our century. And towards the end of his life, he wrote in Ends and Means this: I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning. Consequently, I assumed that it had none and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He's also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he, personally, should not do as he wants to do, or why his friends should not seize political power and govern in the way that they find most advantageous to themselves. For myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system, and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. We objected to the political and economic system because it was unjust. The supporters of those systems claimed that in some way they embodied the meaning, a Christian meaning, they insisted, of the world. There was one admirably simple method of confuting these people and at the same time justifying ourselves in our political and erotic revolt. We would deny that the world had any meaning whatever. Now this, I suggest to you, is the root of this debate about creation. It does not lie fundamentally in a scientific controversy, but in a moral rebellion. Men would rather live in a world unhampered by the inhibiting presence of a creator God. They prefer evolution with a capital because it makes no moral demands upon them. Indeed, twisted in the right way, it can be used to justify practically any course of action they want. And this is the reason, ultimately, I suggest to you, why man in the 20th century is determined to destroy the credibility of Genesis 1. Not because the idea of a seven-day creation is offensive to his science, but because those first four words of the chapter spell the end of his moral licentiousness. In the beginning, God. If it was God who had the first word in this universe, then we can be absolutely sure it will be God who will have the last word. Be honest. If you're an unbeliever this morning, it's not because evolution provides an insuperable intellectual obstacle to faith for you. No, ultimately, it's because you don't want to see yourself as a creature. That's what it is. Let's pray together.